Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Dogs may be men's best friends, but cats are much loved as well, and there's an entire history of the bond between people and their pets. This week, we'll take a look at the role pets have played at court or in the lives of royalty. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1430, Joan of Arc was captured by the Burgundians. France was at war. The crown was in dispute between Charles, son of the former King Charles VI, and the English claimant to the throne, Henry VI, allied with the Duke of Burgundy. In 1428, Joan, the daughter of a tenant farmer from Lorraine, was led by the voice of God to go to Charles's support. At first, Charles did not take the 16-year-old girl dressed in men's clothes seriously, but eventually she persuaded him to allow her to lead his army in battle to liberate the city of Orleans, then under siege by the Burgundians. Although wounded in battle, she quickly returned to her troops and victory. Encouraged by her success, Joan persuaded Charles to press on to Paris, but during one of the battles en route, she was captured by the English and their Burgundian allies, tried as a heretic, and on May 30, 1431, burned at the stake. When the French, under Charles VII, eventually triumphed, Joan became a national hero who was celebrated in France every year on the second Sunday in May. In 1920, Joan was canonized, St. Joan, by Pope Benedict XV. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Egyptologists recently unveiled their latest discoveries at the 8th International Congress of Egyptologists in Cairo. First, they reported that they discovered the remains of a 4,000-year-old Queen's Pyramid south of Cairo, complete with texts of special prayers previously found only with kings. The pyramid belonged to the wife of King Pepi I. In another discovery, archaeologists found a painted tomb in the western desert from a 600 BC culture that exported wine to the Nile Valley. The tomb is in the Valley of the Golden Mummies, 215 miles southwest of Cairo, where last year 105 mummies were found during the excavation of a vast cemetery of Greco-Roman era tombs. And the third discovery involved the finding of two additional chambers in a corridor in the collapsed pyramid at Meidum. The ruins, some 56 miles south of Cairo, date to about 2600 BC. The new rooms, however, have so far been seen only through an endoscope, a 33-yard-long flexible tube used for such non-invasive explorations. You are listening to Talking History. Just what is it about animals, or at least some animals, that we want to take them into our homes and into our lives, much like family? For this week's interview, Talking History's Eileen Dugan explores that subject, or to be more specific, the history of pets in the lives of kings and queens.
There is something special about the bond between people and their pets. We look at our animal companions, and we are amazed that they give us so much, amusement, comfort, loyalty, unqualified love, and demand so little in return. To our pets, it doesn't seem to matter whether we're rich or poor, living in a palace or in a dilapidated shack. They just love us for ourselves. Those who don't have much find great consolation in that sentiment, but so too do the wealthy and powerful, from the Stuart kings and their spaniels to Queen Elizabeth and her corgis. Why? Joining us today to explore the world of kings and queens and the animals they love is Catherine McDonough, author of the recent book, Reigning Cats and Dogs, A History of Pets at Court Since the Renaissance. Welcome, Ms. McDonough. How have you found royals throughout history especially needful of animal companionship?
Well, I think it's exactly what you were saying earlier about all of us, but that animals give us an undemanding companionship, which we cannot expect to get and don't indeed expect to get from any human beings. But in the case of royalties, of princes and princesses and kings and queens, I think that situation is polarized because they can trust people perhaps even less than we can, and they're brought up in such a rarefied atmosphere that they soon get to depend on their animals, perhaps earlier than commoners.
And when do we begin to see portraits of royals with their pets?
We first really, I think one can increasingly put back the clock on that, but essentially in the early 15th century, principally with the works of Van Eyck, his Hours of Turin, with the Count of Holland, but also in the books of ours, increasingly I think we must see the little dogs particularly, we could obviously see fewer cats at that time, as being portraits of real pets, not emblematic animals. I think just as Renaissance studies are pushing back the date of the Renaissance, you can also push back the date of royal pet portraiture.
And why did they begin to include their pets in their portraits?
Well, I think there are several reasons, some coming from the monarch himself or herself, and some coming from the painter. I think painters probably very sensibly realized that incorporating a portrait of a royal pet, in other words, capitalizing on royal sentimentality towards an animal, could secure them a place at court, or could mean that their place at court was less menaced by competition. Could also, in many cases we know, perhaps not for the 15th century, but later on, that meant they could command a higher price, just as they could for, you know, details of all kinds. And for monarchs, I think the main reason was as a tribute to those animals, which after all are necessarily very short-lived, and it was a way of a memento, if you like, of that animal.
What are your favorite pet paintings from the royals?
Well, I think, I'm sure I'm like everybody else in having a great love of Titian, and I would place Titian as probably the earliest really important pet painter in the sense that he is the first to paint a master and his dog without all the paraphernalia in the background, like the full panoply of monarchy, just the monarch and his dog. So much more attention is focused on the dog, like the famous picture of Federico Gonzaga and, you know, one of his 100 lap dogs, which is a very grand painting, but he succeeds by showing the obvious pedigree of the dog, reflecting the pedigree of the prince, rather than having other symbols of royal pedigree, if you like, behind him. And I'm also, which may seem rather incongruous, but I've come to be a great admirer of Landseer, who I think we all think of as perhaps slightly corny, but looking at his paintings more closely, I think one realizes he was enormously witty in a lot of his paintings, and there's a certain historicity about them. He clearly modeled some, like his portrait of Eos, on the Gonzaga picture by Titian. And so there's a sort of nice link-up there. But it's very difficult because, for all the obvious reasons, most royal pet portraiture is of the highest quality. And so they're all pretty well all magnificent portraits, apart from maybe some of Queen Victoria's, which get very chocolate boxy. And I mean, the this century royal portraits, I'd say, were not quite of the same caliber as they were before.
How were royal pets maintained?
Well, certainly until, and still to a certain degree from what little one's allowed to know, in incredible style. Until really the early 19th century, they were treated exactly as the family was treated, except possibly better in the sense that they had easier access around the palace, where the queen might not be allowed to enter the king's quarters. Certainly the dogs were, the cats were. So they were fed certainly the same foods. They slept either on the royal bed or in magnificent baskets. They had, where they wore collars at all, these, of course, were very magnificent. They often had clothing to keep them warm. They were groomed quite frequently, depending on the sort of dog that they had. Really, nothing was spared. No expense was spared.
You mentioned the grooming. Did the royals ever do the grooming themselves?
Yes, occasionally. We know that Queen Victoria groomed certainly her spaniel, Dash, and I'm quite sure later on that I didn't find any proof of this. We know that Edward VIII, when he left England after abdication, his last phone call was to his dog groomer to know how to do it. So that would suggest that he hadn't done it much before. And as he was leaving for Paris, he probably didn't have much need of it once he got there. But certainly the intention was there. A lot of monarchs seem to have taken to grooming their animals in moments of stress. The Kaiser went and bathed his dogs at the moment of the declaration of war to find some relaxation. So it certainly happened. But of course, monarchs were notoriously, until this century, indifferent to the filth of their animals. They might enjoy grooming them because it was fun, but they weren't particularly worried about cleanliness at all. In fact, they often seemed to get quite a slightly sinister pleasure out of their dogs being as filthy as possible.
Oh, my. Well, so far we've been talking about how the royals have loved their pets and such, and yet they could also, the pets, that is, could also be a great source of annoyance to members of court or even members of the royal family. How would you describe that?
Well, I think they often were a huge annoyance, apart from what I've just been describing, as the fact that they were allowed to do exactly as they liked, which, of course, meant some of the... how can one describe them? More animal, I suppose. They functions which their masters merrily overlooked because they had other people, of course, to clear up after them. But they also, we have a present, a very close example, in fact, which is very interesting, of the royal gardeners of Her Majesty the Queen have recently been complaining because she reduced their number, and as a result, the corgis in the palace grounds, the depredations of the corgis have caused more trouble because there are fewer gardeners to clear up after them. It's only going to show the old age problem of actually reducing royal staff. And the famous case, of course, was Caesar, Edward VII's dog, which seems to have been a total menace to anybody who came into contact with it. And everybody described it as very smelly, though he was bathed certainly at least twice a week. And Edward VII heartily encouraged to behave as badly as possible and got enormous amusement out of it.
And as I recall, you mentioned as well that Louis XIV was often bitten as a child.
That was, in fact, his father who was bitten. Louis XIII was a child, was very frequently bitten. He was a very great dog lover and certainly... extremely intrepid in his youth, and it's not very surprising, was bitten a great deal. I don't think he minded being bitten. I think what he objected to is when he was bitten, his parents always took the side of the dog. But you must remember, of course, that then we're talking about the early 17th century, and they had, although they knew about rabies, they had no understanding of the causes of rabies, and or indeed had very limited and primitive attitudes to medicine generally.
How did pets comfort their owners in times of crisis or approaching death?
Well, if we go back to the earlier period, the early modern period, of course, little lapdogs were actually called comforters. And it was believed that by keeping one of these little fluffy, or not so fluffy, dogs on your lap, particularly for women, that any pain of a woman would pass into the dog, and hence their name as comforters, which doesn't mean they loved them any the less, but it obviously meant for a very strong symbiotic relationship between women and their little dogs. And it was just their total ignorance, of course, that led them to believe this. But it obviously would have attached them to these animals much more. And I think mainly the comfort they got from their dogs was psychological. As you said earlier, they could rely, they knew these dogs would never, any story you ever hear of a dog abandoning its royal master is almost certainly apocryphal, because we all know that dogs do not do that unless they are abandoned, and they very rarely were. They also, of course, have the great merit of being unable to gossip. Unlike anybody else at court, they're not going to sell the secrets of the bedchamber. They're not going to talk to the newspapers. They are there in total confidence, which, as one can understand, is extremely appealing.
And I recall there was one story in your book about a dog supposedly committing suicide.
Yeah, but that was a dog of... in fact, there are several stories of dogs committing suicide, but the best one is certainly the tale of Marie Antoinette's dog committing suicide when she was transported from the temple, where she was first imprisoned, to the conciergerie, which is where they went before the guillotine. And apparently her dog was not allowed to accompany her. And the story goes that it barked and tried desperately to get in at all the gates, but couldn't, and threw itself into the Seine. But in lieu of any evidence of a suicide notice, it's quite hard to believe. Anyway, she did finally have a dog in the conciergerie, and was not sure whether it was her original dog or a dog she adopted during her final confinement.
So pets gave great comfort to their owners as they were approaching death, but also how did royal owners care for their ailing pets, and how did they mourn their deaths?
Well, it's a very, very touching story. Whether they actually did anything concrete for their dogs when they died, obviously that depends, and it's to some extent a question of fashion. I mean, the Renaissance, it was very fashionable to build, you know, great mausolea for your dogs and have the best poets write epitaphs and elegies, and it was all very much in keeping with the time. But, I mean, the Queen today still has headstones erected for all her dogs when they die, and so there is a continuity there throughout history. But certainly no expense ever seems to have been spared when it came to sick dogs, and when they had litters. So there seems to have been far more interest in their dogs having litters than there ever was in their queens having babies. In a way, Louis XVIII of France once said, a king can die, but a king cannot be sick. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. To his subjects, the king must always be very strong, must be very virile, must be essentially, except in the past, a man of war, a great soldier. So the idea of being ill is contrary to that concept of kingship. So when a dog went sick, I think they could allow all that sympathy, which they weren't allowed to show, which wasn't part of royal etiquette, if you like, they could show it to their dogs. And so it poured out. Frederick the Great, who certainly showed no sympathy ever, as far as I could see, to any fellow human, was absolutely devoted to his little greyhounds, and they were all bitches. And whenever they had litters, he'd write to all his family, saying, you know, describing all the details and how many pups they'd had, etc., etc. Enormously sentimental about their dogs, even where they might show none towards their fellow humans.
We've been talking so far about mainly royals and their dogs, but did they keep other types of animals as well?
Well, strangely, probably as pets, rather less than some of their subjects, because they were, of course, presented with an enormous number, not just of rather extraordinary animals, but also, of course, just ordinary dogs and cats. I mean, people would always give them presents in the hope that this would forward their careers. But the most exotic things, of course, came from the East and were given by Eastern potentates to Western monarchs. But these were, in the Renaissance, they were housed in royal menageries and, you know, throughout Europe and indeed in the East. And in the 19th century, these menageries became royal zoological societies, which then had access from the public, etc. But very few, they're normally, apart from birds, parrots, monkeys, of course, it's mainly cats and dogs, with the other animals going to the menageries. There were, of course, I do have in my book a wonderful portrait by Mielik of the Count of Haag at the court of Bavaria, who had a pet leopard, and he used the leopard in hunting, but it was also very much his pet and was his companion when he was imprisoned. But on the whole, it's perhaps rather more ordinary than one might hope.
We only have a moment remaining, but in summary, what do you think your study of pets at court says about people and their pets in general?
Well, I think all that pets at court tell us, apart from wonderful stories and very touching stories, they tell us about the nature of royalty, and in that sense, which has not changed from the Renaissance, really, and their attitude to their courtiers and what life is like at court. And in the end, what I found, it tells a very sad story of the loneliness and the vacuum at the heart of monarchy when it comes to their personal relationships. And I think it's exactly the same as it is for us, except on a much grander and therefore in a way much sadder scale. Because normally we find one or two people we can trust. But I think for monarchs, even with their own children, and there are many examples in history, they are foremost, except if they're good kings, they are first and foremost monarchs, and they are parents very secondarily. So pets have a far more important place in their lives than they do in ours, and they have a big enough part in ours.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. McDonough. We have been talking with Catherine McDonough, author of the recent book, Reigning Cats and Dogs, A History of Pets at Court Since the Renaissance.
Me and you and the dog. Traveling and giving off the land. Me and you and the dog. Now I love me and you.
Ever since George W. Bush visited Bob Jones University and was accused of sharing the anti-Catholic bias with which that university has been charged, candidates in the 2000 presidential election have scrambled for the so-called Catholic vote. But what exactly is the Catholic vote, and what does it mean to be a Catholic voter in the United States? Here to give us his historical response to that question is Matthew Redinger, professor of history at Montana State University in Billings, Montana.
What does it mean to be a Catholic voter in the United States? During this election year, some politicians appear convinced that denominational loyalty can be exploited for political gain. As political candidates strive to forge constituencies in preparation for November's elections, candidates across the political spectrum have tried to appeal to the so-called Catholic vote. Although politicians have seen Catholics as a political force in this century, a Catholic black vote simply does not exist. Throughout the 20th century, Catholics have proven far too diverse and sophisticated, both politically and socially, to constitute a cohesive bloc. In 1936, some Catholics tried to forge a voting bloc against Franklin Roosevelt because of his good neighbor policy towards Mexico. To American Catholics, the anti-clerical Mexican Revolution threatened their religion. Baltimore's Archbishop James Cardinal Curley used the Catholic vote in a carrot and stick effort to get Roosevelt to support a pro-Catholic agenda in Mexico. Curley assured Roosevelt that 30 million American Catholics were ready to vote either for the president or against him. Unfortunately for Curley, the Catholic bloc never materialized on election day. American Catholics were more concerned with the Depression than they were about international affairs. In this year's presidential campaigns, we see the resurrection of the threat or the promise of a Catholic voting bloc. In John McCain's run for the Republican nomination, he appealed for the Catholic vote against George Bush because of Bush's address at anti-Catholic Bob Jones University. Bush tried to defuse the issue by claiming that he did not support the school's anti-Catholic heritage, although he refused to distance himself from the institution until after he had won the South Carolina primary. McCain's tactics to attract Catholic support may have been new, but his goals were not. His campaign used a pre-recorded telephone message to paint Bush as anti-Catholic. This recalls the 1936 presidential campaign when priests used the pulpit to apply that same paint to Roosevelt. These tactics then and now simply failed. In the 1930s, Catholics supported Roosevelt's effort to deal with the economic emergency of the Depression. Ironically, not economic crisis, but a distinct lack of economic problems is likely to prevent the formation of a Catholic bloc vote this year. Like most Americans, Catholics tend to be comfortable and therefore more willing to overlook lapses such as Bush's speech and late apology. Prosperity promises to lay an axe at the root of bloc mobilization as effectively as Depression did 65 years ago. This is a lesson today's politicians might well heed. Political candidates would be wise to remember that private interest groups have historically demonstrated incredible diversity. Forging a Catholic bloc vote didn't work in 1936, and it simply will not work in 2000.
You've been listening to Matthew Redinger, professor of history at Montana State University in Billings, Montana. Professor Redinger's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. State Route 79 in Missouri follows one of the nation's grandest rivers. It also takes you to the hometown of one of America's greatest writers. Here to tell you about that route and hometown for our historic site of the week is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Following Missouri's Route 79 along the Mississippi River is a beautiful sight, especially in the spring and fall when the color of the leaves of the trees along the shore appears to leap right at you. The river played an important role in author Samuel Clemens' life, so while on Route 79, stop in the town of Hannibal and catch a tour of the river aboard the Mark Twain, and there is also the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum, a complex of six buildings in the historic district that are a must-see as well. You can visit the cave where the expeditions that were immortalized in Tom Sawyer took place, and there is lots to see and do along Route 79 in Missouri. And maybe, if you listen closely, the river will give you a few stories of your own.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, the History Channel will soon air three fascinating programs. On May 30th, Discharged Without Honor will look at the Brownsville Raid of 1906. On August 13, 1906, a group of men shot up the streets of Brownsville, Texas, killing one man and wounding another. Soldiers of the all-black 1st Battalion of the 25th Infantry were blamed, and President Theodore Roosevelt ordered all 167 discharged without honor. The May 30th History Channel documentary offers new information on what really happened that night. On May 31st, Mike Wallace takes a look at bomb-wielding madmen and political activists in recent American history in his program 20th Century. Included among these mad bombers, as the show is titled, are George Metesky, who planted 33 bombs in New York City in the 1950s, Timothy McVeigh, Ted Kaczynski, the Weathermen, the FALN, and those responsible for the World Trade Center bombing. Immediately following Mad Bombers, watch for Devil's Island, Hell on Earth, in which the History Channel tells the hellish history of the French penal colony that served as the final stop for France's incorrigibles and political prisoners from 1852 to 1945. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact times of these programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our Memorial Day program, when we will take a look at the history of the war in Vietnam. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.